Hello, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, the Heart Guy, welcoming you to another exciting and informative podcast titled The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter, bringing you interesting discussions and conversations related to the vast and important subject of heart disease and heart failure and everything related to that in today's ever-changing world. I'm extremely honored to have as my special guest today an inspiring leader in the medical and global communities, Dr. Hugh Kasseri. Dr. Kasseri is a pulmonologist at North Shore University Hospital in Manhasset, New York. And Dr. Kasseri has been in practice for more than 21 years. He has subspecialties in critical care medicine, infectious disease, pleural disease, and pulmonary vascular medicine. And besides North Shore, he's also affiliated with Southside Hospital, Long Island Jewish Medical Center, North Shore Medical Center in Miami. And Dr. Kasseri is also the proud husband of Cindy and the father of two daughters and a son, Daniel, who made some ridiculously scrumptious looking blueberry French toast, which I am not allowed to eat. So welcome to our show, Dr. Kasseri.
Thank you so much, Gary. That was a great intro.
My pleasure. So I was going to say, before we get into the especially important issues that you're overseeing in our hospital now, please tell us a little bit about your childhood. Like, where'd you grow up and what made you want to become a doctor when you were younger?
Yeah, great question. So I'm a Queens boy. I grew up in Richmond Hill, Queens. I've been a New Yorker my whole life. Moved from Richmond Hill to Briarwood, went to college at St. John's University, which is also right down the road from Briarwood in Queens, for those of you who know the neighborhood. And then what got me interested in medicine? I was an average student, believe it or not. And I came across a textbook that one of my cousins gave me. It was called Anatomy and Physiology. I happened to open up the book and there was a chapter on the human cell. And I was just completely over the top fascinated. And then I just went crazy with learning everything I possibly could about the human body. And that translated into wanting to become a doctor I think I was in 11th grade. I was a junior in high school. And after that, I just really had one focus, and that was to become a doctor. And then from college, I went to Stony Brook, where I graduated. And then I did my fellowship in pulmonary critical care and internal medicine.
Yeah, and pulmonology. So how did you select that specialty?
Yeah, so really interesting. So I originally matched for anesthesiology. I had a real loving for pharmacology, and anesthesia always fascinated me, the whole biology and physiology between anesthetics. And when I started my internship, one of my mentors, Dr. Michael Niederman, who is a pulmonary critical care doctor, convinced me that pulmonary critical care was really the way to go, not anesthesia. And during my training, I actually changed from anesthesia into internal medicine and then pulmonary and critical care. And I think a lot of that had to do with my first day as a junior doctor was in the medical intensive care unit. And I just loved critical care after that. And it's been an affair since.
Wow. Yeah. And, I've had the pleasure and the luck of having you as one of my doctors up there in critical care at North Shore. So now we're a bit curious about what's critical care like now at North Shore? Like, how has it changed in the presence of COVID-19?
Yeah. So, this last year, I don't need to tell you or your audience, it's been a year like no other. At North Shore, Manhasset, we have about 92 ICU beds. During the peak of the pandemic, we had over 200 ICU beds. Right. We went from 5 ICUs to 11 ICUs. And what COVID really taught us was that we could pretty much do anything anywhere. We had recovery rooms turn into ICUs. We had two of our medical floors turn into ICUs. And what we learned real quickly is that we could monitor patients pretty intensely, even not in our usual intensive care units. And the other thing COVID taught us is, we're on silos. There's a neurosurgical ICU, a surgical ICU, a medical ICU, a CCU, and then my cardiothoracic unit, we all worked together, but what COVID did is COVID brought us all together and knocked down the silos and made us one big working team. And I got to work with people that I normally wouldn't have gotten to work with, and built relationships. And building those relationships, you sprinkle a little of critical care in all the other units, and you walk through and pass through a year, and you acquire knowledge and friendships that you would not normally have had had it not been for COVID.
That's great. And I know that collaboration, I know as far as I'm concerned, collaboration is so important for optimum outcomes for the patients as well. And being together, I'm sure that that, you know, even strengthens that a little bit more.
Yeah, Gary, you know that firsthand, because when you were in, you know, where you were in the hospital, you were taken care of by a team. It was critical care, heart failure, the surgeons, the physician assistants. It was a whole big team. COVID just blew that up and made it even more expansive.
Right, right. You know, one of the differences, I had been a patient in a number of hospitals, and one of the things that was so noticeable for me at North Shore was the similarity between North Shore and like the Mayo Clinic, where it was so patient-centered and so collaborative. There wasn't a feeling of hierarchy. I was very comfortable as a patient there, and I think that's very important to the success of the treatment too.
Yeah, and we're, you know, we work with different, you know, I work with different specialties, but, you know, I consider myself, we're all one team. That sounds kind of corny, but as a team, and you were in the middle, right? You were the focus of all of our care. And I think that's what makes a difference. It's really, again, it's going to sound hokey, but really patient-focused care. And everything after that just falls into line.
Absolutely. And you're now known to use therapeutic hypothermia for COVID-19 patients. I understand that that works by cooling down the body to decrease the metabolic rate, which stops the body from using so much energy. And that treatment had incredible results. Is that still the treatment? And have there been any new therapies for COVID-19 patients, particularly extremely ill patients like I was?
Yeah, so I got to tell you, that was fascinating how we kind of stumbled upon the hypothermia. We discovered this towards the end of our first surge. So we really didn't have many other patients to use the therapeutic hypothermia on. And there's actually a large NIH-sponsored trial that's being done by other centers looking at therapeutic hypothermia that I'm not involved with, unfortunately, because I'm not running one of the COVID-19 ICUs, but I've gotten contacted by literally people all over the world asking for the hypothermia protocol. Wow. As a method to treat the sickest of the sick COVID-19 patients.
Yeah.
So hopefully that study will be, you know, published in a couple of months, maybe a year, to see if it what therapeutic hypothermia does with COVID-19. I can tell you from my experience, again, I'm biased, I guess, is that it was pretty dramatic findings with the patients who are the sickest. In terms of new therapies for COVID-19, God, I wish I could tell you good news. All we really have is remdesivir and dexamethasone steroids. There's really nothing else on the horizon. There's better data now for these drugs called IL-6 inhibitors. But again, they're considered standard of care under certain settings, but we really don't have a blockbuster drug like a good strong antiviral that stops COVID-19 in its tracks. We're really left with, and Gary, you know this, we're really left with vaccinations. Prevention is going to turn out to be the best battle for COVID-19. So far, not therapeutics.
Right. Yeah, for sure. I think it's important for our listeners to know that even with the vaccine having been taken by so many already, that we still need to pay attention to close contacts, closed ventilated spaces, poorly ventilated spaces, crowds. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So again, the devil's in the details with these vaccines. So, you know, give you good examples. You can be vaccinated and still get infected.
Right.
And even if you don't feel sick, you can carry the virus. And if you're not practicing social distancing, hand washing, and everything that you just mentioned, you can transmit it to those who haven't been vaccinated, or those who have been vaccinated, you can get them sick. So we still have to, hunker down with everything we have been doing, even with the vaccinations.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of this has to do with, one of the biggest populations we're not vaccinating now are children. And we know that they're carriers of COVID-19. And just now, I believe it's Pfizer, is going to the FDA to get emergency use authorization to give the vaccine to 12 to 15-year-olds. Wow. So we have a long way to go. So until we start vaccinating kids, we're gonna need to hunker down and do the mask, hand washing, stay away from closed spaces, and everything that you had mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we have a lot of people that have gone through COVID fatigue, and you know, they're itching to get outside, but they still have to be careful. There's confusion in the messaging, and we have to educate the public on all these things so that we stay in a positive way with regard to controlling the virus.
Yeah, you know, we're all stir crazy. I just want to jump out of here. now's the time to not let the guard down, because you know we can easily make COVID-19 something that just doesn't go away.
So it's like the Yankee games and the Met games now, even indoor events like basketball and hockey. Is this okay to go to for people, or is that still not a great idea?
Well, if you're outdoors, you're okay. Mm-hmm. Outdoors is really not an issue. It's once you start bringing things indoors with poor ventilation. Now, what do we mean by poor ventilation? You know, you go to a venue, you're not even sure what the ventilation is like. So I think being indoors for me is probably the highest risk. What scares me the most is reopening of indoor dining.
Yeah.
Notoriously, restaurants, they don't really have a lot of ventilation. Luckily for us in the Northeast, the weather's getting better. So you can keep the doors and the windows open, but being indoors is for me the highest risk of any activity.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense. I'm in a Facebook community of congestive heart failure patients and people who have already gone, or should say undergone, heart transplantation. And specifically with regard to heart transplantation, are transplanted patients particularly vulnerable to COVID-19 with all the immunosuppressives that these people take and the steroid medication as well, even after the vaccination?
Yeah, so there's some data that literally just came out, Gary, that showed, and you're not going to find this surprising, neither are your listeners, that if you're a transplant patient, whether it's kidney, liver, heart, you're on immunosuppressants, the vaccine is less efficacious. Not that it doesn't work, but it's less effective as it would be in someone who's not on immunosuppressants, which makes sense because the vaccines work through your immune system.
Yeah.
And then the flip side is if you do get COVID-19, you're immunocompromised. So it's almost like a double whammy. And I've taken care of a fair number of, unfortunately, some transplant patients who've gotten COVID-19. And, you know, they get sick like everybody else. So definitely more vulnerabilities. And this is not to say not to get vaccinated. The data still shows that it helps. But it's definitely less efficacious. But it's the best thing you can do for your health at this point if you're a transplant patient getting the vaccine.
That's good to know. And are we transplanting the hearts of patients who have had COVID-19?
So as far as I know, no. You know, there's a lot of data now on patients who have hepatitis B. But so far, if you've had COVID-19, the donor, it's pretty much a no-no at this point.
Yeah, because I'm obviously aware of marginal donors and Hep C as well. I signed off as accepting a marginal heart, of course, because it increases the donor pool, and I think that's important, especially in New York here.
And the good thing though is there's great treatment for that.
Right.
Really great treatment for that. So that's it. That's really been a game changer, Gary. I know you know that firsthand. That opening up the pool to the hepatitis patients being able to donate their organs has really, really changed a transplant, across the globe.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious because I got the sense, or I get the sense, that people who've worked in the fields of healthcare, like myself, for as many years as I did, have sort of a predisposed immunity to certain viruses. Is there any data on this sort of thing for healthcare workers?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, in general, the common cold virus is a coronavirus.
Right.
You do build immunity to it, but the immunity only lasts a couple of months, which is why you can get the cold like four or five times a year. So not even if you build immunity to certain viruses, that immunity wanes. So, for instance, in the healthcare setting, one of the most common viruses that we come across, at least for the last year, has been COVID-19. And the data is, and we've had patients who got infected way back in February and March of 2020. And believe it or not, they still have antibodies over a year later.
Wow.
So depending on the virus really depends on your immune response. And I don't know if that answered the question, but that's probably the best answer I could give
Yeah,
you.
I know. Well, there's certainly no certainty as far as these things. It's so new that we're finding out a lot of things as we go each day. But thanks to people like you, we're getting a lot of answers as well. So it's great that we have you and your team, who I know you work so closely with. As you probably know, I'm involved with New York State Contact Tracing Initiative, which at this point has morphed into more of a vaccine confirmation initiative than a contact tracing initiative, although it depends on how the numbers go, with people getting outside again. But as far as travel is concerned, domestic travel and so forth, is there anything new that we need to know about heart disease as it relates to the virus for traveling?
Yeah, great question. So the good answer is no. So as long as you wear your mask on the plane and the hand washing, and when you're off the plane doing the social distancing, and especially in those patients with heart disease, hypertension, coronary disease, and even heart failure, it's really the taking those precautions. So in other words, you can travel. But it's you gotta take precautions, like if you were going to be going out to a restaurant.
Yeah, we got to be careful. I know, and the airports are so crowded, that's another scary part of the whole thing.
Yeah, and you know this that you know one of the reasons why I think the good weather coming, at least in the Northeast, is a godsend. If you take a look at last year towards the end of our pandemic, our first wave, once it hit May and June, you noticed our curve started to flatten and COVID numbers were really low. So I think we're going to see the same thing now, and we're going to get a boost on top of that with the vaccinations. So I guess what I'm saying is I think the warm weather, more outdoors venues, the better. Indoors, I'd probably stay away from. Traveling, if you have to travel. And again, like you mentioned, airports, I mean, the terminals are huge, but if you pack a couple of thousand people in there, the ventilation, may, put you at risk for getting the virus if you're not prop and I'm going to say properly wearing the mask.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I didn't mention is the two mask rule that the CDC seems to favor right now. Two masks are better than one. The first mask should be a surgical three-ply mask, and then on top of that, a cloth mask. So if you're if you're listening, your listeners or your heart pa your heart listeners, the CHF patients, the patients with hypertension and coronary artery disease, if you're going to travel, please wear a surgical three-ply mask, and on top of that, a cloth mask. You will be maximally protected from getting the virus.
It's great advice. Thank you. Yeah, and it's easy enough to do. I joke with people because I was a dentist for 36 years and I wore a mask for 10 hours a day and I washed my hands 100 times a day. So it wasn't a big adjustment for me. But a lot of people were against wearing masks and, not used to all this hand washing and it's really not a big ask. You can get used to doing those things and hopefully most of us have taken that on.
Yeah, and wearing the mask below your nose is like not wearing a mask.
Exactly. Yeah. We try to control ourselves, but we always suggest to people that maybe that they don't realize that their mask has fallen down. That's the advice
Yeah.
that we usually try and give. Just to change the subject a little, I see that you're involved with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Foundation. How did you become involved in that area of healthcare?
Well, one of my one of the one of my friends who's a physician assistant who is a practices gastroenterology developed lymphoma.
Yeah.
And we're doing fundraisers for her. She's responding to treatment. But I got involved to get my unit involved to try to raise the awareness of leukemia and lymphoma for funds for research. I think it's on Facebook, and it's gonna hopefully help not just my friend, but help others who been afflicted with leukemia or lymphoma. You know, I'm sure she's going to make a full recovery. This is just my way of giving back to try to help as much as I can
Wow.
with fundraising for a good cause.
Yeah, amazing. You know, you not only are up there all the time, and I know you put so many hours at the hospital, and now to do this on top of that, your dedication to the field is just amazing. So we thank you all for that
Thank you, Gary.
for sure. I've seen you personally up on the floors interacting with your team of nurses and other support workers, and there's a way that you interact with them that I can tell you makes them feel safe and confident in their work. And that's pretty special. I even saw that thing about Do George to the Rescue, where I think you built out the room for everybody to enjoy themselves a little bit on their downtime. Is that right?
Yeah, so I'm a well, if you round with me, it's you know, the intensive care unit's very stressful. We take care of very sick patients, and the patients are also stressed and anxious. You know that, Gary. So
Yeah.
I see my role as not just taking care of the ICU and taking care of patients, but calming people down, bringing it to level down where we're all kind of interacting on a personal level. It translates into the nurses being comfortable, the physician assistants, the nurse practitioners, and the patients being comfortable. It's a very holistic way of, at least when I'm up there in the unit trying to run the ICU, because we're human beings as well. We feel the stress. And you know, as a patient, you can sense if your caregiver walks into your room if they're under stress, right?
Yep.
And that can't be a comfortable thing. So one of the
Yep.
things we try to do up there is we try to help each other. You know, we try to you know, get through a difficult day with you know, just being human to each other and helping each other out and ordering lunch together and just talking amongst ourselves and just making it feel like it is a workplace, but it's also a special place where we do God's work and take care of each other, not just the patients who are in the unit.
Yeah, and this is the most serious work. And I know as a doctor myself, I was a surgeon, and to not have stress when you work, you do much better. My staff did much better when they were not under stress, and same for me. And so it's really important, and only benefits the patient. So it's another, you know, feather in your cap as to the way that you interact with your staff, and the patients are very aware of that. I can tell you firsthand that that is true.
Oh, thank you very much. And I also go at it, what we don't do enough of in the hospital is thank each other. And I know it sounds silly, but I find myself all the time just I was on this weekend. One of the nurses got a very one of our patients who doesn't have a lot of mobility. You know, she was able to get the patient up out of bed to chair, and it was an ordeal. The patient benefited. He was able to come off the ventilator, and I just went over to her and I said, "You know what? Lindsay, you did a great job. Look what you did. Look at the smile on this guy's face. He's off the ventilator now. This is because you did that." Now, the smile on her face and just the recognition for just that simple recognition of the job that she did, we don't do that enough. And I go out of my way only because, you know, my unit, I'm biased, I guess. I think it's the best unit anywhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, we got to thank each other for the good job that we do because, you know, at the end of the day, it's all about patient care. But you know what? It's tough work. It's
It's
tough
tough
work.
work.
And you know, you have to recognize those who do the tough work.
Yeah, and gratitude is interesting because it not only benefits the person on the receiving end, but I find that when you have gratitude or show gratitude, it actually benefits yourself as well. I think there's benefit for both sides of that.
And the
So,
patient, he
you
had the biggest smile on his face as I was telling her this.
know.
So
Yeah. So it benefits
the whole
everybody.
kind of room kind of lit up. It just kind of changed the whole dynamic.
That's great. That's great to hear. Well, Dr. Kasiri, it's been my great honor to have you as a guest on The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter. And on behalf of myself and our listeners, I thank you so much for all that you've done for our community on Long Island and the global community with your incredible dedication and for sharing this time with us. I hope we can do this again soon.
Thank you, Gary. This is a pleasure. I'd love to be back.
Yeah, great. And this is our podcast for today. Please join me next time for another intriguing, informative, and entertaining conversation. Please visit our website at www.drheart2heart.net. That's DRHEART, the number 2HEART.net for upcoming podcasts, or if you would like me to host an online presentation for your group or organization. If you would like to be a guest on The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter, podcast, please email me at theheartguyspeaks@gmail.com. Our podcast can be found on Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Spotify. And this is Dr. Gary Sherman, The Heart Guy, wishing you peace and hope.